Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're here to celebrate the 4th this week, second only to Thanksgiving in our minds as far as the eating goes. We've culled some of our best eating advice from the likes of Mario Batali, Claudia Roden, Sally Schneider, Josh Wesson, and the one and only Julia Child.
Julia, what comes to mind when I say the 4th of July to you?
Oh, picnics and hot weather. I love potatoes. I've got a very good potato salad. But I think the most important thing is to cook the potatoes properly. So I slice the potatoes first, and then I cook them in lightly salted boiling water, and I keep tasting them just to make sure that they're just done, because I think that crunchily undercooked potatoes are horrifying.
That was from our very first national broadcast 20 years ago. Stick around. There's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. July 4th marks independence, getting outside to celebrate, and reveling in the great eats of summer. For us, there's one more thing. This weekend marks our first broadcast 20 years ago. 30 stations had signed on, and we launched with a diverse take on eating in America. The legendary Southern cook Edna Lewis, the granddaughter of slaves, talked of growing up on a farm in Freedomtown, Virginia. Meat expert Merle Ellis told us how to save a bundle on those cuts for the grill. Sam Arnold, food historian and restaurateur, talked chilies and eating in the Old West. And then there was the Queen, Julia Child, who thought a radio show about food was a good, if not a tad odd, idea. This was that first phone call to Julia.
Well, let's have a little fun. There's someone I know who really knows how to celebrate life. She's a very special lady, and I'm dying to know what she's going to be doing on the 4th. Her name, by the way, is Julia Child. Some of you may have heard of her. Now, I've got her home number, and the amazing thing about Julia is that she's so available to those of us in the food profession. She's always there to help in some way or another. By the way, do you know that she films Master Chefs right in her own kitchen? She has the best restaurant range. But let's find out what Julia's doing on the 4th. I wonder if she's got a good recipe for potato salad.
Hello?
Hi, Julia.
Oh, hi.
Hi there. It's Lynn Ross.
Where are you?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Oh, is it beautiful there?
It's gorgeous here. And we're talking about the 4th of July. And I was wondering, what comes to mind when I say the 4th of July to you?
Oh, picnics and hot weather.
Definitely hot weather. You know, you and Paul spent so many years living outside of the United States. Did the holiday take on a special significance during those years?
Well, it did very much so when we were in Paris. We got there in 1948. That's a long time ago. But the American Embassy always had an enormous reception for all the Americans in Paris, and they had it in the lawn of one of their sort of embassy houses. And they were just thousands of people there.
Did they do hot dogs and hamburgers?
No, they didn't. It was very French as to what they did. Because I don't think... I guess it's so long ago, I can't remember. Yeah, but it was very good because they had an excellent chef. I know what we do here, which is hamburgers and potato salad, and I love it.
Oh, that's great. Julia Child eats hamburgers. Have you got a favorite recipe for the 4th of July that you might be able to share?
Well, I love potatoes. I've got a very good potato salad. But I think the most important thing is to cook the potatoes properly, because I've had an awful lot of potato salad in where the potatoes, you know, were not quite cooked through, and you just can't eat it. That takes all the pleasure out of it. So what I like to do, I slice the potatoes first, and then I cook them in lightly salted boiling water, and I keep tasting them just to make sure that they're just done, because I think that crunchily undercooked potatoes are horrifying.
What kind of potato do you use?
Well, I use the either a brand, the new potatoes or the red potatoes. So I think you have to have one that's going to boil properly. But I think those Yukon Gold are awfully good.
They really are.
I think they're just delicious.
Yeah, and they look so good.
And after you boil them and they're just right, then you drain them out, and while they're still warm, you toss them with some finely minced shallots or scallions or very, very finely minced sweet onion, and then salt and white pepper. And I put in either a little potato cooking water or a little chicken stock and a little bit of wine vinegar to taste. And just very gently toss them around. Then we have celery and dill pickle, and I like a little crisply cooked crumbled bacon, diced hard-boiled eggs, and I was usually canned red pimento and some fresh minced parsley, and toss that all around, because I think you don't want too much mayo in it.
That sounds so good, the idea of the broth.
I think you have to be very careful folding it so you don't break the potato. Now, what cut of meat do you like for hamburgers?
Well, for me, I personally love the chuck.
I do too.
Yeah, I think it has superb flavor. And I'm one of those people that feels very strongly that I may not eat it very often, but when I do, I want my beef to be luscious and succulent.
I'm that way too. I hate fake food. But I think people are really so nutty now that they hear you have to watch your fat, and then some people give it up entirely.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, I think you're right.
Fortunately, I'm right, because you can't have any fun eating that kind of a diet. All you can eat is vegetables and legumes, and to hell with that, I think. I talk to nutritionists all the time, and I think most of the ones, well, I don't talk to the ones that I don't agree with, anyway.
Yeah, well,
I think most of them say, try for 20% fat, and you'll probably end up with 30, which is just right.
I agree with you, and I think the other thing that we've really missed the point about in the way we eat here is we tend to overdo all the time.
Oh, we certainly do. If people say, watch it out, then people give it up entirely.
Yeah, and the idea, you and I talked about this a long time ago, moderation.
Moderation, great variety. I think small helpings is very useful, because we're used to being so generous in our helpings to this company.
Julia, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It was great fun, Lynn, and you have a very happy 4th of July.
And you too, dear. Thank you.
Potato salad.
I'm going to do it.
Okay.
Take care, Julia.
Bye.
That was Julia Child from our first national broadcast 20 years ago this weekend. And man, did I talk fast then. Well, you can find a favorite recipe of mine for the 4th, old-time potato salad, on the website, splendidtable.org. And I think Julia would approve. Summer in a glass. That is what good iced tea is to me. But making a good iced tea is not always easy to do. A few years ago, tea expert Bill Boddington of Tea Source joined us to dispense the last word on how to make a perfect glass of iced tea. It's good to have you back, Bill.
It's great to be back here, Lynn.
I'd like to talk about iced tea. Is there a single sort of best way to make it?
I have my favorite way to make iced tea, and maybe we'll call that the best way.
And it's yours, of course.
Because, the reason I love it is because it's the easiest way to make tea in the world of any kind. You don't even need to know how to boil water. It's a cold brew method. All you do is throw some tea leaves in a pitcher or a jar, at bedtime, at nighttime, fill it full of tap water, throw it in the fridge. In the morning, voila, you've got a whole pitcher full of iced tea. Never even heat the water. It extracts the flavor over the course of the evening while you're sleeping. In the morning, you've got beautiful iced tea. And it comes out so smooth. It has no edge to it whatsoever, any tea that made that
And, you strain off the leaves.
And you strain off the leaves, or you have the leaves in a strainer to begin with of some sort or another, or a filter bag. Absolutely. And it comes out so beautifully smooth.
That's so surprising. I mean, it does sound like this method of making coffee where you soak the grounds overnight and then you strain it. But doesn't the heat bring out nuances in a tea that – you want?
An ice brew tea will be a little bit softer. It will be a little bit gentler.
Right.
And you can get more of an edge. If you like an edge, if you like astringency, yeah, brew hot tea. But I'll tell you, this method is what got my wife off of Diet Pepsi in the morning, every morning as she left to go for work. She'd just make a pitcher of iced tea at night.
A tea merchant's wife drinks Diet Pepsi in the morning. I love it, Bill.
She used to.
Is this, I mean, when you say put in the tea and put in the water and leave it, well, you say put it in the refrigerator, but what are your thoughts on sun tea, where you leave it outside?
Sun tea is a great concept except for the idea of the sun, because what you're doing is you're taking wet vegetable matter, which is a tea leaf, throwing it in a pitcher, throwing it out in the sun for 8 hours. I've had a lab scientist tell me once that's what they do when they want to grow bacteria. Cold brew iced tea is the perfect answer because it's the same mechanics except you're putting the pitcher in the refrigerator instead of the sun.
Okay, so do you use more tea in proportion?
Less.
Less tea?
You use less tea when you...
Even though it's going to be diluted?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know why that is, but it's absolutely true.
Huh.
Use about 2 tablespoons per half gallon of water.
Okay, so now you've got a cup here.
Here's a green mango iced tea that we brewed up the cold brew method. And green teas are tough to brew for iced tea with hot water because it's so easy to turn green teas bitter with too hot of temperature water. That's why they're perfect for the cold brew method.
I have to tell you, this smells like a fresh cut mango with something acidic behind it. It should... Oh, that's so subtle, but so good.
Sweet note comes through? Does the fruity come
through? Yeah, the fruity comes through. Mm. I get a little bit of almost lemony quality from it. I can taste a green tea here.
Good.
That's great. And this will work with black tea.
This method works for all teas. If you like a really strong tea with a little bit of a bite and a little bit of an edge to it, I would choose a Ceylon tea or an Indian tea and do it with a hot brew method and cool it down afterwards.
Okay, Bill, I want to just go over this. We're talking about to make iced tea, you do 2 tablespoons of tea to a half a gallon of water. You put it in the refrigerator overnight, and then you strain it, right?
That's it.
That's it?
That's it.
Any kind of tea?
Any kind of tea. It'll work great.
And once it's strained, it'll keep how long?
Easily 3 to 4 days.
It's fabulous.
Good. I'm glad you liked it.
I guess I shouldn't ask you about your thoughts about the powdered
you get what you pay for.
Okay. Bill, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Bill Waddington is owner of teasource.com. You can find Bill's advice for that classic iced tea, as well as ideas for other cool summer drinks like agua frescas and iced coffee, on the website splendidtable.org. Coming up, Mario Batali walks us through the Italian vegetable patch and what is the best wine for pairing with sweet corn. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. No longer are chefs judged by their pork belly prep or their fused Asian-Lithuanian tacos. Now it is all about the magic that they can do with a kohlrabi. Vegetables reign. And one chef, our pal, Mario Batali, was deep into vegetables long before a lot of cooks could spell kohlrabi. Credit this to his native genius, his Italian family of extraordinary cooks, or his years in Italy, a country that knows its way around a garden patch. Hey, Mario, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hey, could we talk Italian vegetables?
Because I think that we should.
I don't think anybody really gets them except the Italians, and they do them like no one else on earth. What do you think is sort of the secret trick that Italy knows that we don't?
Well, Italy understands probably that it's better to buy something in season than something not in season. And the fact that you wouldn't serve a strawberry in December or you wouldn't serve asparagus in November is already the first step to understanding how great things can taste.
So I can't have asparagus on my Thanksgiving menu.
You can. And that doesn't make it bad, and it doesn't make you evil. It's just such a different animal to take things out of season and that have been traveling a long ways when you can taste something that was local or at least grown in season somewhere where it's really a specialty.
So it's more about shopping initially.
Well, I would say that is the key to all Italian cooking.
Absolutely.
It's really more about just understanding how easy it is to cook things if you buy the best product that you can find. When Italian grandmothers walk into the produce store, they don't look for the parsley that's 7 cents off because it's 3 days old. They want the best parsley, and there's not that much of a difference in price. It's just a question of a difference in ideology.
What about once you get into the kitchen?
Well, that's where the real game starts. The best thing about the Italian way with vegetables is it's not a technical masterpiece to make something taste really, really good. Often enough, it's just a really hot oven or a really hot pan, and you put things in there with olive oil and a little sea salt, and it tastes, worst case scenario, exactly like it looks. Best case scenario, 10 times more exciting than anything can ever happen, just because it had a development of a caramelization, or it's roasted, or it's spiced in just the right way. Most importantly, you want things to taste like the vegetable itself, with a little bit of anointment.
And the Italians don't cook vegetables the way it's chic to do them here.
No, we do not. It's rare that you will blanch a vegetable, then shock it in water, although sometimes that happens. Cooking green beans, for example, or cooking asparagus, more often than not, Italians just throw it in the pan with olive oil on medium-low heat and cook it until it's cooked all the way through. Not al dente, not super bright green, but when you put it in your mouth and you taste it, it screams green bean.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking about, that kind of bringing out every bit of the flavor. Mario, let's get into this book.
Okay.
You have got a ton of vegetable recipes. What are some of your favorites for now?
Some of my favorites for right now are the concha of zucchini, but I also like the verdura in scapece, the pickled vegetables under the antipasti. One of the suspicious and tricky things about Italians' love for vegetables is they often serve them as an antipasto, less so than as the side dish to a main course. They love to have three or four different kinds of vegetables before they start anything. And then have a side dish with their main course.
Yeah, yeah. So that they really star. You focus on them in a very different way.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things I think when you talk about zucchini that a lot of people don't realize is that when you brown a zucchini, it changes entirely.
Absolutely.
And do you have any way you like to do that? I mean, do you have a chef's trick?
The main event to getting zucchini really brown is either having a really hot pan or a hot grill, or doing very small batches. If you fry them, if you cut them into little quarters, little thin chips, and you put 7 or 8 at a time into a pan with a couple tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil and cook them until they almost look too brown.
Mm-hmm.
Take them out. They still seem a little soft. You put them on a little paper towel to kind of drain. And in 3 minutes, you have something nearly as crisp as a potato chip that doesn't taste like that thin white disc was when it was raw. It tastes like the expression of everything that could be right in the summer heat.
Do you do anything with celery?
I love celery. Celery is one of my favorite vegetables, and as it is of the city of Rome, and I'm totally down with the Roman ways, we do it in several ways. Probably my favorite way is fried. We take it and just kind of slice it into little pieces, then we dip it into a little cornstarch and egg, and then put it in extra virgin olive oil, and then just cook it until it's deep, dark, golden brown. It takes on a flavor when it's cooked that way that is spectacular.
How about turnips?
One of the things that is always surprising to a lot of people is the cooking of the different regions, particularly the Northeast and the Southeast in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of turnips, I think of the cooking of Friuli, I think of the cooking of Trentino, those very northern, very nearly Austro-Hungarian places. So I like to roast turnips with poppy seeds and paprika and a little bit of vinegar. And they come out so exotic tasting, just from a standard turnip. And you could substitute a beet in there or a rutabaga in the same way. And they come out so good and so delicious and evocative of an Italy that is a different place than when you think about spaghetti, meatballs, and pizza and lasagna.
Yeah, and spices we would never think, or most
right,
people
exactly.
never think of being Italian. Hey, Mario, thank you, love.
My pleasure. I'll always come visit you, Lynn.
You're invited.
Thanks.
You can catch up with Mario on weekdays on ABC's The Chew. Now, he left us with a recipe for a very much overlooked but truly delicious vegetable. Take a look at Mario's pan-roasted turnips at splendidtable.org. Wine expert Joshua Wesson is the master of figuring out which wines will really fly with which foods, like Twinkies with Asti Spumante, and I'm really serious, it works. On the more practical side, a few years ago we asked him for some advice on what to drink with the great foods of summer, the things you don't necessarily pair with wine. Hey Josh, it's good to have you back.
I like no better place than to be here with you, Lynn.
We've got a challenge for you this month. Okay, all the goodies are coming into the market. I want you to match wines, not to meats and fish, but to fruits and vegetables. Okay, stone fruits like apricots, nectarines, peaches, for instance.
Let me think. Let me pull my imaginary beard here.
Okay.
Well, there's a raft of wines that are perfect with peaches and nectarines and apricots when they're ripe. And all of these wines are made from a version of Muscat. Muscat's one of the most widely planted white grapes for turning into off-dry and fully sweet wines.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple that I think are particularly good with stone fruits at the height of ripeness in summer. You just, you know, peel the peach, cut it up, stick it in a little bowl, pour some of this wine over it, keep it in the fridge for a couple of hours, come back, and you don't need anything else. That's your dessert, and you'll have a magical wine and food combo.
That's exactly the kind of thing I was thinking of, but now I want you to name some names.
Yeah. And I'd put a little creme fraiche on there, too, with a sprig of mint.
Okay.
And I'd be insanely happy. If you're looking at a Muscat-based wine from Italy, Moscato d'Asti, the grown-up cousin of Asti Spumante, would work. If you're highing on over to Portugal, there's a wonderful Muscat wine called Muscatel de Setubal, really wonderful, rich, heady wine. It smells just like peaches, in fact. There's an old guard sparkling wine from France, which is making a bit of a comeback now, called Clairet de Die. Usually they're off-dry, incredibly aromatic. And the one that I'm going to go for today comes from the southernmost reaches of the Languedoc-Roussillon. And it's a fortified wine. It's got a little bit of brandy added to the fermenting Muscat grapes to stop the fermentation and freeze it in a sweet place.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a trio of wines in this little part of France, Muscat de Rivesalt, Muscat de Frontignan, and Muscat de Minervois. And Minervois is a famous place down that part of the world for making red wine. But if you just look slightly to the left of center there, mm-hmm. you'll find them. All the winemakers are drinking Muscat while they're making their red wine.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it Muscat de Minervois. And it is a heady, heady potion to have with a bowl of peaches. And I put a nipple on mine and I just, you know, lip it. It's great.
Okay, now that was easy, but I got a tough one now. Tomatoes. You've got acid and sweet. What would you team with the tomatoes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the riper a tomato is, the more you need fruit in the wine to catch up to the implied sweetness or real sweetness of the tomato. And I love rosés, rosados from Spain, rosatos from Italy, in almost all their guises because they're just natural partners, not only in terms of their taste profile, but the way that they look. Next to a plate of tomatoes, a glass of really wonderful rosé is a great thing. I particularly like rosés from Italy. And a lot of people, when they synapse to a wine for tomatoes, they're thinking tomato sauce or chopped tomatoes in a salad. And they're thinking about, you know, Chiantis, Tuscan wines, Sangioveses. There's a Tuscan wine that I tasted about 2 weeks ago. Made from Sangiovese, but it's a rosé, a rosato, and it's from Castello di Ama. And this wine was born to mate with tomato dishes, and they can be cooked tomatoes, they can be fresh tomatoes, they can be dressed with olive oil, they can be cut up on a plate and sea salt put on and nothing else on. This is the wine for tomatoes in the world right
okay.
now.
Okay. All right. Final challenge, sweet corn.
Well, sweet corn's easy because you get a kind of nuttiness from the corn, and of course you get sweetness. And I found that unoaked New World Chardonnay is a slam dunk, nothing but corn husk combo with fresh corn, especially if it's just been boiled or steamed or sliced off of the cob and then put into some kind of like a corn salsa. There's nothing better than an unoaked, almost sweet, in-your-face Chardonnay. And it can come from Australia, it can come from Argentina, but this is where California unoaked Chardonnays really sing. And Callaway makes the mother of unoaked Chardonnays. They kind of invented the notion of it. And this war horse of unoaked Chardonnays is fantastic with boiled or steamed corn.
Okay, Callaway Chardonnay. You have risen to the challenge. Thank you.
I live to stand up.
Wine authority and reformed sommelier Joshua Wesson has Best Bottles Wine Shop in New York City. And you can find his suggestions for summer wine pairings at splendidtable.org. Claudia Roden and Middle Eastern food are practically synonymous. Her seminal work, A Book of Middle Eastern Food, first came out in 1968. It was the first of her many books on the foods and life of the region. She's inspired so many writers and chefs, including Yotam Ottolenghi, who's a huge fan. Well, I talked with Claudia after the publication of her book, Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. I wanted to know more about grilling in the Middle East, a delicious tradition that's often overlooked in the West. Claudia, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Claudia, one of the traditions I would like to talk about, and I'm tying this into the grilling season here, is the tradition of cooking meats over an open fire or over coals, which, from what I understand, is done, of course, all over the Middle East.
It is. It's been a traditional way of cooking for many, many years and, well, centuries even, all over the Middle East and North Africa. But it is more the tradition of the street. It's street food, and it's also kebab house food and restaurant food. In the days when there were hardly any restaurants in the Middle East and North Africa, there were always little kebab houses or just somehow a vendor with a few tables and chairs outside would serve kebabs. But now people actually do this, not necessarily at home indoors, but when they go on a picnic or in their balcony.
One of the things that I would like to focus on is the kefta, this idea of the flavored ground meat, because I think it's something that we are not that familiar with. It resembles a hamburger, but it's far beyond that. Could you talk about what is the basic idea behind kefta, and is this something that's common to much of the Middle East?
Yes. Kefta is certainly one of the favorites of the meats. The other one is shish kebab, and those are lamb cubes that are skewered and cooked. But the kefta is really what you would call minced meat, or rather chopped meat, because the very best makers of kefta are in the restaurant trade. They do it in view of the customers, and they do it by chopping very, very finely the meat. It's usually meat with some fat, because it does need fat, otherwise it becomes dried out. And the most common way of making a kofta is with parsley and onion. And you chop the onion very, very fine, and you chop the parsley very fine and the meat, and then you chop them together until they become almost a paste. But at home, most people actually these days make it with a food processor, and they chop the meat first. Not, it mustn't be a quite a paste, but be still a little bit grainy. And they chop the onion separately and the parsley separately. And the onion is drained so that the juice doesn't stay in. And then with your hand, you blend it well until it sort of forms a kind of paste. And you add salt and pepper and place it on skewers. And the skewers have to be a certain type. They've got to be flat, a flat blade, but also a bit thick so that the meat doesn't either get cut or else roll about on a thin skewer. And in some places, they just make one long skewer completely covered with that meat. In others, they like having little lumps and like sausages all the way. And in some places, they even put in between them a piece of onion or a piece of tomato or a pepper. But usually they do it just the meat itself. In different countries, they have different flavorings. Usually it's just salt and pepper, onion and parsley. But sometimes, like in Turkey, there's cinnamon and allspice.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yes, it is. And in Morocco, it's other kinds of spices sometimes get in, like ginger, for instance, or cumin, and also cinnamon sometimes. But the thing that you can do to enhance it, apart from serving it with bread or with rice, is to grill vegetables at the same time, and they're eaten together. But there's also various ways of serving these, and it's different in different countries. For instance, in Turkey, it is sometimes served with yogurt, and the yogurt can be mixed with a bit of garlic and a little bit of dried mint, and that's poured on top. And sometimes also served with a bit of tomato sauce. Sometimes sumac is a spice that is sprinkled on.
It's sort of so lemony, right?
It's a lemony flavor.
Yeah. Well, Claudia, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Claudia Roden is the author of the new book of Middle Eastern food, but quite frankly, pick up anything that this woman has written. Well, she left us with a recipe for Moroccan kebabs, something we would welcome on our 4th of July grill. You can find it at splendidtable.org.
Coming up, your summer food questions and a super new way with fresh cherries from Sally Schneider. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time for us to connect with you. You can get to us any way you'd like. Email splendidtable.org, Facebook, Twitter, or 800-537-5252. Okay, Martin is calling from Rehoboth, Delaware. And I think I must have not said that correctly, Martin.
No, you did. Rehoboth, Delaware.
I can't believe it. I'm great. I'm great.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk to you. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, this might be a little different for you because I'm looking to you for inspiration, not just for my table, but also for my garden.
Oh, this is hysterical. This is the woman who can grow herbs, and that's about it. You realize.
Oh, that's okay. But maybe you can help me because I'm not even good at that. My garden is never about the practicality of vegetables. It's always about painting flowers with a garden.
Oh, I love it.
I'm a painter and a designer, and, you know, for me, food and the way it looks is so important because I always think it tastes good if it looks pretty.
Right, right.
So I'm kind of looking for ideas about, are there any edible flowers besides the typical nasturtiums and pansies that you see everywhere?
Well, yeah.
You know, that especially in the summertime when you've got all this great fresh fish and fresh vegetables, you know, what would work with that and what would complement those flavors?
Oh, my. Well, you know about the nasturtiums. I mean, the leaves and the flowers, they have a wonderful flavor. Okay, anything in the marigold family is edible? And it tastes the way it smells?
Is that good?
Well, no. It's a green, aggressive. Well, no, I shouldn't say. The blooms are not that aggressive. I use marigold petals and dandelion petals the way you would use saffron.
Oh, okay.
You know, I put them in liquids and maybe broths. It may be rice, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, so there's the marigold / chrysanthemum family is edible. This is, we're assuming, no sprays. Okay.
Right, exactly.
Violets are edible, roses. As I recall, some of the lily family, I want to say daylilies are edible. The petals are. Jasmine, mimosa, and depending where you live, those are available or they're not.
We can grow jasmine here.
You can grow jasmine. Okay, that's edible as well. And now one of the things that's done with that in the old olden days, people candied those flowers so that in a way that they actually look like the flower but with a coating of crystal-like sugar and then just use them to decorate. But the you know, one of the things I love is that chives, it's very brief, but they get beautiful flowers. And herbs get flowers, you know, like thyme flowers, rosemary flowers. Every herb gets some sort of flower. It's usually not a big splashy flower, but it's quite lovely.
Now, once an herb goes to flower, is it then bitter in terms of the leaves?
If it's an annual like basil, yeah, the leaves turn bitter. The leaves are not fun, but the flowers are very pretty. They don't last a long time. But one of the great cooks I knew in Italy, she used to dry those flowers, and she used that as the flavoring for basil. And and they were really – it was really delicious. I mean, it was a completely different sensation, but it was great. So I think – and if you're talking about things like working with fish, I'm just thinking how lovely it would be to, you know, stuff a fish with something like – rose petals. Although rose petals, you know what? Rose petals are wonderful if you steep them in cream.
Really?
And then make something like either.
Is anything bad with cream?
Well, no, nothing really is, as a matter of fact. And violets are the same way. And of course, lavender is edible.
Yeah, and the scent is fabulous. But anything creamy, like if you're going to make ice cream, you're going to make panna cotta, you're going to pour cream over any kind of fruit, you can warm it very gently with those flower petals in it. And then let it steep a half hour, strain it, but then scatter the petals over the fruit. So imagine cut up strawberries with a pitcher of cream. You pour some cream over, or you whip the cream, and then you scatter the petals of the roses over the berries. I mean, this is drop-dead gorgeous. And do you remember, like, Water for Chocolate, the film?
Yes. Oh, my God, yeah.
Well, the idea of doing things with mellow, velvety chili, those kinds of sauces, where you then add rose petals or you add violets. Do a honey dressing, honey and lime, with something like rose, violet, and let that steep a little bit and then drizzle that over a piece of hot fish from the grill. It would be unbelievable.
It would so, be so I don't good. Know whether to start with dessert or the main course now.
I always say start with dessert. The sugar will give you a lift and then you can move on.
I'm just really sure that you think like me.
And I have to say, my dream is to have your garden. I think it takes genius, it takes an artist's eye, and it takes someone who really knows what they're doing in the garden. So my hat's off to you.
Well, thanks. You're welcome anytime.
I may show up. Martin, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Lydia's on the line from Iowa City. Lydia, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about fresh oregano. I am inundated with the stuff. It grows about 3 times faster than all my other herbs, and I don't know what to do with all of it, so I was wondering if you could suggest anything where fresh oregano is sort of the main event rather than chopped up and sprinkled on there.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I know what you mean, by the way, because there was there were a couple of years when my herb garden was going full bore. I had never seen a plant spread. I thought mint spread.
Yeah.
It was turning up in the garage at one point. You know.
Exactly.
But this is the thing, because oregano is strong. It's not like basil, you know, where you can use it by the handful. It's pretty strong.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Okay. There's a classic combination of oregano and capers and garlic and lemon zest.
Ooh.
Yeah, and a little olive oil. And that combination is really kind of neat because you can rub it on almost anything. It's unbelievable on lamb, but it's great on eggplant. It's good. You know, when you grill onions,
mm-hmm.
you put some of that on top of it. You mix it. Use that as a topping for a sliced tomato salad. It's just fabulous.
Okay.
I'm just thinking of condiments you can make with it because it's pretty powerful. The other thing I think what I would do is I would wash it well, let it dry completely, you know, on a drain board or whatever, so it's not wet. Strip the leaves and freeze them because you're not going to – I don't have any way of telling you how to use the amount you've probably got right now.
Yeah.
Without killing everyone with the taste. But remember, it works brilliantly in Mexican food. Obviously, you know, yeah, because oregano – granted, it's Mexican oregano. It's a slightly different beast than probably the one you have. But you can get away with it. So that means it's great with any beans. It's wonderful with things with chili. Like if you want to make a classic chili salsa, you take dried red chilies, you soak them in warm water, and then what you do, you take off the stems. If you want to, you seed them, drain them, put them in a blender with garlic, oregano, and a little fresh water and salt and pepper. You puree that, and you've got the beginning of a salsa.
Oh, wow.
But I would say freeze a pile of it. You're going to be able to use it all winter. You will have enough to get you through until next summer.
I am sure I will. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lydia. Enjoy the oregano.
I will. Bye. Bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. From Salt Lake City, we have Devin. What's up? What is on your mind?
So I want to throw a French-themed summer party. Ooh. But most French recipes that I find are in the kitchen braising and poaching, and I want to be outside with my guests. And so I was thinking it would be fun to involve the grill, but I'm also having trouble finding recipes that involve a grill in traditional French cooking. So I was wondering if you could help me out and give me some ideas on that.
Well, what kinds of things are you thinking of serving? In the best of all possible worlds, what kind of thing would you like to serve?
So I'm actually vegetarian, but I also eat fish. But I'm willing to do something like chicken as well.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. As far as chicken goes, I have a trick with chicken. Chicken on the grill to me is still Russian roulette. You know? I mean, really, I've been grilling for a long time and I just have learned, save yourself aggravation. cook the chicken inside and finish it outside. And you can do it ahead. Yeah. Now, one of the fun things you could do is that you could take your chicken and you could rub it with garlic and lemon and a bit of olive oil and black pepper and salt. Okay. Mm-hmm. Put it in the fridge overnight. And if you don't like to rub it, have somebody else do it. Okay. No, because I can understand. When you know, you've decided not to eat animals, you don't necessarily want to do a lot with them. But if you put that in the fridge overnight, just lightly covered, cut it up into small pieces. And then what you do is you make a Dijon dressing. You know, so that's Dijon mustard, some minced shallots, salt and pepper, but not too much because the Dijon mustard already has seasoning, good oil and good vinegar. And you whisk that together. And you roast the chicken in your oven at about 325, really nice and slow, brushing a bit of that dressing, maybe a total of about a quarter of a cup of that dressing on it as it cooks. Okay, so you see what I'm saying? You're cooking the chicken ahead, and what you're going to do on the grill is brown it, crisp it, and heat it through. And you're going to take that Dijon dressing, have it in a pitcher or a few pitchers on the table. The chicken will be put down maybe on a bed of herbs, you know, or parsley, something where it looks like it's actually nested. But here's the point. The dressing is the sauce you drizzle over the chicken at the table, and it's just delicious. The same thing could be done with hunks of fish, but I wouldn't cook it ahead. You could grill whatever you normally like to grill on that grill, whatever kind of fish you like. And then think about a wonderful green herb sauce from the south of France where you have capers and you've got a little bit, if you like, anchovy. If not, leave it out. And you have a bit of fresh oregano and you have lots of fresh parsley and fresh mint and a bit of fresh basil, but a lot of mint and parsley. Throw that in the food processor with a little bit of garlic and a tad of olive oil and you just let that go. And if you want to throw some nuts in, throw in nuts, pine nuts. Almonds are wonderful, and that becomes your sauce. And then shortly before you're going to serve it, you give it a squeeze of lemon juice. And then, of course, you can take wedges of those little new potatoes or just the round potatoes, and you can roast them. In fact, if you want to, you can bury them in the coals. Do you use a gas grill or do you use coals?
Gas.
Use gas. Okay, then best not to bury it in the gas grill. Carrots. Dip them in a little bit, you know, roll them around in olive oil and coarse salt, and then you can grill them slow. You know, have one side of the grill hot and one side of the grill very low, and you can keep switching things around. And you can do that with eggplant and sweet peppers. And you know the other thing that's wonderful, lightly grilled, is whole sugar snap peas.
Oh, but really?
Do them in one of those grill baskets. Okay? Now, for the vegetables, you can mix up heavy cream, a little bit of the Dijon mustard, a bit of the shallot, and a ton of fresh dill.
Oh, I love dill.
Yeah, and that'll be another sauce that you can, you know, put over that. And those are all things that are easy to do. You can do the dressings ahead, and the aromas are going to drive people to total distraction.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It'd be awesome to do much ahead.
Right, and then for dessert, you can do a huge fruit tart.
Yeah.
So there you have your lovely French. You could call it, you know, a fête from the south of France. Let's call it that. A little fête from the south of France.
Sounds good.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Take care, Devin.
You
Bye.
Too. Bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime you want, 800-537-5252. Sally Schneider is a pro who cooks by feel and lots of imagination. Her book, The Improvisational Cook, well, I think it's a must for kitchen rookies. And the improvisational premise of that book spawned her website, Improvised Life. It's packed with lots of ideas, like, for instance, the genius take she brought us on working with fresh cherries. Sally, hi. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Lynn.
So how do you get the most out of a fresh cherry? What's your take on that?
First is buy a good cherry, which means buy a nice, plump, firm cherry that's not overripe and not underripe. I go for Bings because they're the most delicious and common. In farmers markets, you can find other varieties sometimes. These are sweet cherries. Sour cherries are meant for cooking. But for serving fresh cherries, my all-time favorite thing to do is put them in a bowl, add some ice to the bowl, and then some water, and let them sit for about 5 minutes. There is nothing like an iced cherry as a dessert, and all you have to do is put little bowls around for people to put their pits and stems. I suggest you have a lot of cherries if you're going to serve them this way. They're just addictive.
All right, so now if you want to gild the lily.
Here's a simple pairing is fresh cherries with some creamy goat cheese, maybe with a few leaves of thyme on it. Another thing I like to do, actually, is pit the cherries and toss them with some lemon juice and sugar until their juices run. Then I mash them into a really good vanilla ice cream with a dash of balsamic vinegar. It's kind of like an impromptu cherry ice cream, which you can't buy anymore. And if I'm really in the mood to keep morphing things, I throw it in the blender and turn it into a cherry milkshake.
That sounds incredible. Okay.
Yeah.
Cooking cherries. Do you cook both the sweet cherries and the sour cherries?
Yes. You can cook both of them exactly the same way, adding lemon juice and sugar. Those are essential components, and you would just vary the amounts depending on the kind of cherry. That being said, for my money, sour cherries are the best for cooking. They have the most complex flavor, and it's a very old-fashioned cherry flavor, actually. So then, if you're going to cook a cherry, the question inevitably comes up of whether to pit or not to pit. And you have a couple of options. You can use a hand pitter, which you do one by one, or you can get one of these $20 chute pitters where you throw a bunch of cherries down a chute and with a plunger action, you pit them. So I used to do that. And then one day I took several baskets of cherries that happened to be sour cherries. I didn't realize because I didn't have my glasses on, to a friend's house for dinner. They had stems and leaves. We were both exhausted. We were pulling together a dinner party and we looked at the cherries and we looked at each other and said, we need to pit these. And I said, why don't we just throw them in the pan and see what happens? So we did. We did this kind of sauté braise of sour cherries with stems and leaves, served them in a big bowl with alongside of a bowl of creme fraiche. And each person could pick a cherry by its handle and pop it into the creme fraiche and then into their mouth.
Ooh. And you would sauté it with sugar?
Yes. So they were plump and bursting with juices and warm. And you'd eat them one at a time. Your fingers would turn red. The delight at the table was incredible, and you just put the stems and leaves in a little, we put bowls around the table, and you throw away the stems and leaves. It was a revelation and a liberation because I realized you don't really need to pit the cherries.
This is ideal, and the work is absolutely zilch.
It is zilch. That's exactly right.
Thanks, Sally.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Check out all of Sally Schneider's thoughts on ideas and tools that inspire at improviselife.com. You can get her recipe for warm cherries at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Irma Bombeck, who said, you have to love a nation that celebrates its independence every July 4th, not with a parade of guns, tanks, and soldiers who file by the White House in a show of strength and muscle, but with family picnics where kids throw frisbees, the potato salad gets iffy, and the flies die from happiness. You may think you've overeaten, but it's patriotism. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Consider splendidtable.org as your go-to source for great recipes, weekly e-newsletters, download our podcast, and find information about anything you've heard here. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.